VOAAfrica.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Bin Laden's secrets revealed. Ukraine conflict simmers as EU summit courts former Soviet states. Yemen faces a humanitarian emergency.
What we found were traumatized populations, people afraid, upset, and struggling to meet their basic needs.
And an American comedic talk show host says goodnight after more than 30 years. These and other stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. The U.S. government Wednesday released scores of documents, it says, were recovered during the 2011 raid in Pakistan on the compound where U.S. forces killed al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. It includes a variety of declassified documents, personal letters, a list of English language books, think tank studies, software and technical manuals, and material published by other militant groups. VOA's Jeffrey Young spoke with Seth Jones, director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation.
What is the significance, in a broad sense, of the release of these documents? Typically, the intelligence community hasn't given their documents to the public. This time, they're doing it. Why?
Well, actually, this is part of a broader effort over the past several years to provide additional information about the way al-Qaeda's operated. There were documents released from this trove a few years ago. There have also been a number of documents released from al-Qaeda in Iraq. Many of them have gone to the counterterrorism center at West Point. These ones, though, were released directly on the Director of National Intelligence website.
Is this any sort of a tectonic shift? Normally, you know, for years, the intelligence community held on to every scrap of paper. Is there something that has changed in government operations or in the way the DNI is operating to facilitate this?
Well, look, we're living in an age where there's more access to information. In many cases, documents get released without the government's direct involvement. They get leaked in the case of Edward Snowden, for example, or with the WikiLeaks documents. In this case, these are documents that provide us a glimpse of the inner workings of al-Qaeda from its senior leadership, from Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and other senior officials. What they provide in this sense is transparency in how the organization operated. Now, it is important to recognize that this is only a very small tranche of thousands and thousands of documents from the trove captured at bin Laden's complex. So it's important to keep that in context and looking at these ones that are released.
We don't know what these documents are at this point. I mean, obviously the people that have the documents in front of them do, but we, meaning the public, don't. What if there are, for instance, documents that show cooperation or collusion by various governments or various actors or entities? This is kind of interesting because in releasing these documents, might there be some embarrassments?
Well, I haven't seen anything along those lines in these particular documents. There may be that kind of information in other documents that have not been released. Most of this information appears to be communications among al-Qaeda leaders and affiliates in places like North Africa. They discuss issues like the Arab uprisings and how to take advantage of them. So these are really, most of them are strategic-level documents not implicating neighboring governments, with the exception of some interesting information on some of the al-Qaeda affiliates that were and members and family members that were in Iran.
What is the public's benefit by this release? I mean, the average Joe on the street, Is there any takeaway to this, or is it just a matter of transparency?
Well, I think it is important to understand an organization that continues to threaten the United States and the West more broadly, and not just the West, but also threaten a range of countries in Africa, in the Middle East, South Asia, and the broader Asia-Pacific Rim. The rise of the Daesh, or the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, there are a number of other organizations, in addition to al-Qaeda, that are providing a threat. The more we can understand these kinds of organizations, I think the better educated the population in these various areas can be. And what you really gauge, frankly, is that this is a social movement that's not going to go away anytime in the foreseeable future. And that's what people should come away with in understanding.
Do you think because of this release that we'll see any follow-on releases? You say that there are literally thousands of documents involved. So once we get through this first tranche, can you expect additional documents to be released that also came from the same raid in Abbottabad?
I certainly hope so. There's a lot more in there. There's a lot more context that those documents can provide on everything from how Al-Qaeda was able to live and establish sanctuary in Pakistan, relationship with individuals in Pakistan, with Iran, some involvement in strategic dialogue, operational, tactical level details. A lot of that, I think, is helpful in understanding the organization that the U.S. and a range of other Western countries still have to deal with. I don't know whether the U.S. government is going to release more, but it should.
Seth Jones of the RAND Corporation. Social media is buzzing about the bin Laden story. Here's Michael Lippin to tell us about what our audience is saying.
Thanks, Ray. Now, our report about the U.S. releasing documents recovered during the bin Laden raid is one of the top stories on our website, and it's attracted a couple of comments from our readers. Some of them don't think it was a good idea for the U.S. government to declassify the material. Reader Chris Mary from Abuja, Nigeria wrote, "This is not good for public consumption. May God protect us all." Another reader by the name of Brandon had some advice for U.S. officials, saying, "It's far wiser to remain silent on certain matters, and this is definitely one of them. It's doubtful whether the British government or the Russians would ever release documents such as this." That's Brandon's view. A third reader, Nash Davu from the Nigerian city of Jos, appealed to God to bring peace to the world and to help protect it from all forms of terrorism. The VOA article also appeared on the Voice of America Facebook page, where several users gave their opinions of the former Al-Qaeda chief. Urim Urimi Halimi from Brussels, Belgium wrote, "Legends never die, hashtag respect." Another Facebook user, Rajendra Prasad Kandel from the Nepalese capital Kathmandu, had an opposing view of bin Laden, writing, "Terrorists have a tragic end." The bin Laden documents have been a hot topic on Twitter as well. Analytics website Topsy says the words bin Laden have been mentioned in at least 46,000 tweets in the past day. Ray, back to you.
Thanks, Michael. You can follow him on Twitter. His handle is at Michael_Lippin. That's LIPIN. Russia's foreign minister has criticized the United States for participating in Ukraine's affairs, another sign of the heightened rhetorical tone between both countries. Addressing the Federation Council, that's the upper chamber of the Russian parliament, it happened on Wednesday, Sergei Lavrov said he hopes Washington convinces Ukrainian authorities to strictly adhere to the latest Minsk ceasefire agreement and avoid violence. Mr. Lavrov also condemned what he called radical forces in Kiev and other capitals and warned that any provocation to further escalate the conflict would have terrible consequences both for Ukraine and the entire European security system. Six former Soviet bloc countries, meanwhile, will be attending the European Union's Eastern Partnership Summit today in Riga, Latvia. The meeting comes at a time of high tensions between Europe and Russia over the future of the region. Henry Ridgewell has a preview.
Communicating through translators, soldiers from the U.S. 173rd Airborne Brigade train Ukrainian National Guardsmen in counterinsurgency combat. The exercises are taking place deep in the forests of western Ukraine and are aimed at countering the Russian-backed separatists in the east. That simmering conflict forms the backdrop for the European Union's Eastern Partnership Summit. Leaders from Ukraine, Georgia, Belarus, Moldova, Armenia and Azerbaijan will join EU counterparts in Riga Thursday. The two-day meeting is aimed at building relations with the former Soviet bloc states, says Arisia Lutsevich of Policy Institute Chatham House.
We are facing now a new understanding of Europe and its neighborhood and what it means. I think the European Union managed to have a very united position on saying that the countries have a right to decide their future.
The last Eastern Partnership Summit in November 2013 saw Ukraine's then-president Viktor Yanukovych make a last-minute U-turn on signing a deal with the EU under pressure from Russia. That brought pro-EU protesters onto the streets of Kiev, leading to the ouster of Mr. Yanukovych, and months later, Russia's forceful takeover of Crimea. Moscow's actions have driven the former Soviet states closer to Brussels, says Kadri Leek of the European Council on Foreign Relations.
All countries are trying to reach out to the EU more than earlier, including the so-called laggards, the ones who clearly used the European connection in order to balance Russia's influence, especially that includes Azerbaijan and Belarus. They are now scared about what Russia might do.
Along with Ukraine and Moldova, Georgia has signed an association agreement with the EU. President Georgi Margvelashvili says Europe must not be cowed by Russian demands.
The paradigm that Russia legitimately somehow considers that furthering Georgia's European choice is their national threat and somehow Europeans have to take this into consideration, this is an absurd that has to be confronted with a positive European agenda.
But that agenda remains unclear, and full membership of the EU is not on the table, says Kadri Leek.
You can get access to the market, you can get visa-free travel, but will you be able to become a member of the European Union? That has always been unanswered.
The answer is likely to be no, says Orisia Lutsevich of Chatham House.
Europe is not ready to expand its borders and to allow more countries into the club.
While reaching to the former Soviet states, Europe is also trying to ease tensions with Russia.
At the same time, Europe has to decide how it wants to build its relations with Russia, whether it's containment, whether it's confrontation, whether it's partnership.
Ukraine's president has already said he wants to apply for EU membership by 2020. Analysts say that ambition may not be matched in Brussels. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. President Barack Obama says that global climate change poses immediate risks to U.S. national security by increasing the possibility of natural disasters and humanitarian crises. Mr. Obama told new graduates at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in New London, Connecticut, that the effects of climate change will impact how the military defends the United States, and that the world needs to act urgently to combat the effects of rising temperatures. Five of the world's largest banks face around $5.7 billion in penalties for illegally colluding to manipulate prices and currency exchange. Officials at the U.S. Department of Justice said Wednesday that currency traders at these banks worked as collaborators rather than as competitors, making or holding off purchases to manage the prices of dollars and euros. The group of traders called themselves the cartel and used electronic chat rooms and coded language to manipulate rates. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said the huge fines are justified because the prices the market sets for those currencies influence virtually every sector of every economy in the world. Other officials said the euro-dollar currency market is five times the value of all U.S. stock markets. Four of the banks, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, Barclays and the Royal Bank of Scotland admitted violating antitrust laws. The fifth bank, UBS, faces penalties for manipulating a key interest rate. Some of the fines were imposed by the U.S. Federal Reserve and officials in Britain. Here's a summary of the latest world news. The Islamic State group has reportedly captured the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra, raising fears of another wave of destruction of irreplaceable cultural treasures. The development comes just 4 days after the IS group seized the Iraqi provincial capital, Ramadi. Palmyra's 2,000-year-old ruins are a UNESCO World Heritage Site. More unrest in Burundi Wednesday. At least one soldier shot dead in the capital, Bujumbura, as police clashed with protesters demanding President Pierre Nkurunziza not seek a third term in next month's elections. At least 20 have died in 3 weeks of clashes between security forces and protesters. Authorities put down a coup attempt against Mr. Nkurunziza last week. The United States and Tunisia Wednesday signed an agreement boosting security and economic ties. The signing came at the beginning of a state visit by Tunisia's President Beji Caid Essebsi. That's the latest news. I'm Victor Beatty.
UN agencies report the humanitarian impact of the almost 2 month Saudi-led bombing campaign in Yemen and a blockade of fuel and other imported relief supplies is enormous. They are appealing to the warring factions to agree to another ceasefire so essential aid can be delivered to the beleaguered population. Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
UN aid agencies are taking stock of the situation in Yemen following a recent 5-day humanitarian pause to allow for the delivery of life-saving assistance. They say they are extremely troubled by what they see. They say the few days in which the guns fell more or less silent has allowed them to view the extent of suffering being endured by hundreds of thousands of citizens displaced by the conflict. The UN Refugee Agency has revised its displacement figure upwards from 300,000 2 weeks ago to more than 545,000 now. The death toll also has gone up over the past 2 months of escalating fighting. Latest United Nations figures put the number killed at 1,849 and the number wounded at nearly 7,400. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says the temporary ceasefire agreed to by the Saudi Arabian coalition and Houthi rebels has allowed aid workers to access areas that had previously been off limits.
What we found were traumatized populations, people afraid, upset, and struggling to meet their basic needs. In the Amant al-Asimeh area of Sana'a, we interviewed displaced people staying with host families where several households were crowding under a single roof with inadequate bathrooms and water supply. Fuel shortages make it difficult to pump water.
Many people were economically vulnerable before the crisis. Now, Edward says, they are even worse off. He says most have lost their livelihoods and are entirely dependent on aid. He tells VOA the severe shortage of fuel in the country due to import restrictions on commercial and humanitarian aid continues to be a critical issue. He says the lack of fuel is compounding many existing difficulties.
It's pushing up prices. It's making it difficult for people to get about. The amount of fuel we were able to bring in is really only a drop in the ocean of needs, approximately 10% of the amount of fuel needed in the space of a month. So you can see there's significant need to get more in.
The UN Refugee Agency reports the humanitarian pause made it possible to fly in more aid and transport supplies to distribution hubs in the capital Sana'a and Aden. It says in-country stocks of relief items now are 3 times higher than they were before the pause. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And American television comedy talk show legend says goodbye. Details coming up. But first, the woolly mammoth is a thing of the past, but maybe not anymore. An international team of scientists sequenced its complete genome. Led by the Swedish Museum of Natural History in Stockholm, the work opens the door to recreate the huge herbivore which last roamed the Earth 4,000 years ago. Here's VOA's Roseanne Skirbel.
Beth Shapiro is looking for ancient bones at a mining site in Canada's Yukon Territory.
So this is really cool. What we've just found, you can see, is 1, 2, 3, 4 pieces of mammoth bone here. Just heard that big splash of water back there. That means another hole's broken through. Here comes the water. We better get out of here.
In her book, How to Clone a Mammoth, the associate professor of ecology at the University of California, imagines bringing the elephant's ancient cousin back to life. But de-extinction is a complicated process. Unlike Dolly the sheep, cloned in the mid-1990s, mammoths are not candidates for that approach.
There are no living cells, so we can't clone an extinct species.
But genomics offers another pathway. Shapiro says by identifying the genes that differ between the mammoth and its closest living relative, the Asian elephant, researchers set the stage for genetic editing.
In essence, this genome editing technology is going to swap out bits of an elephant genome for the mammoth version of genes that we know are critical to making a mammoth look and act like a mammoth.
But why do that, asks Ross McPhee, curator of mammals at the American Museum of Natural History in New York.
If the animals themselves have no further ecological role because they've disappeared for hundreds or even thousands of years, what does it mean to bring them back and park them in an environment of which they have really no relationship anymore?
Shapiro responds that de-extinction can play a role, not to bring back the past, but to protect today's threatened and endangered species.
If we can create an animal that, by bringing this animal back, or bringing the traits back of an extinct species, we can somehow save living species, or reestablish and reinvigorate existing ecosystems.
McPhee isn't convinced.
I think the only way forward is to have the conversation and get people aware of what the issues are, and one hopes over time to have both political and economic solutions.
Beth Shapiro welcomes that discussion, especially before a de-extinction takes place, which she says, given the technical, ethical, and ecological challenges, will not occur anytime soon. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
An American comedy talk show giant is calling it a night, literally. David Letterman retired Wednesday night after 33 years, more than 6,000 late-night television broadcasts, and 16 Emmy Awards. Letterman's departure marks the end of a legendary career. VOA's David Byrd spoke with Ron Simon, curator from the Paley Center for the Media, about how significant Letterman's been in the world of television entertainment and the talk show format in particular.
Certainly David Letterman has had a remarkable career. He begins in the analog television days. In fact, he comes out of broadcasting, so that he knew all the rules of comedy and talk show. He certainly learned so much from his mentor, Johnny Carson. But the thing about David Letterman is that then he broke all those rules, so that he's the bridge to two different generations of comedians. He's the one who absorbed everything you needed to know for the first era of television, and then he brought a whole new hip sensibility to another era of television.
He also was famous for some of the bits like stupid human tricks or stupid pet tricks or running over blank with a steamroller or dropping something off the top of a building in Midtown Manhattan to see what would happen. Is that reflective more of who he is, or do you think that those were things that you mentioned he broke the rules and so he just did them to kind of wink and stick it in the public's eye a little bit?
No, I think there's a quiet rebelliousness to David Letterman. He was someone who always wanted to push the limits of comedy. And you have to remember that when he began his late-night talk show on NBC, it began at 12:35, he was the first person to ever do a talk show that late. So he was given freedom to develop a different type of way of relating to the audience. Originally, he was told just to relate to the young male college audience, so that he was able to think about comedy very differently. Then he brought a lot of those experiments to a more mainstream audience when he joined CBS in the early 90s.
And it wasn't just comedy. He was also known for his very poignant reflections on 9/11, for introducing his heart surgeons when he had quintuple bypass surgery, and for making a public admission of having had an extramarital affair and apologizing to his wife. There's very few people who would do that, and very few, if any, other talk show host.
You know, the nice thing about David Letterman, you could see him mature over the years. Certainly when he was on NBC, he portrayed himself very isolated, very maladroit at any type of social connections. He was very uncomfortable in his own skin. But during the CBS years, you saw that he took on larger challenges, and he revealed more of himself, certainly with big historical events like 9/11, and also more personal turmoil, whether it be his surgery or his problems with the extramarital affair. But he was able to, I guess, grow more comfortable in himself to talk to the audience about more private, personal matters.
All right, that is Ron Simon. He's the curator at the Paley Center for Media, and he spoke to us from New York City. That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can follow us for the latest news and information at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Political turmoil continues in Burundi, with top government officials being dismissed following a short-lived effort by some military officers to take over the government. On May 17th, 5 days after the takeover attempt, President Pierre Nkurunziza issued a decree relieving the foreign, defense, and commerce ministers of their duties. Even as the president made his first public appearance in Bujumbura to show he was back in command, street protests continued there over his plans to run for a third term. Opponents say that violates the Constitution and the Arusha Agreement that was key to ending a deadly 13-year civil war. Announcement of President Nkurunziza's candidacy triggered street protests, which police tried to repress with water cannons, tear gas, and live ammunition. Estimates are that up to 20 people have been killed, hundreds injured, and hundreds detained over almost 4 weeks of demonstrations. Meanwhile, intimidation and violence by the ruling party's youth militia ahead of the planned May 26 legislative and June 26 presidential elections have caused tens of thousands of Burundians to flee to neighboring nations. The United States is deeply concerned by the potential for further bloodshed, including reports of retaliatory violence following the attempted seizure of power. We urge all parties to seek reconciliation and unity over revenge and retribution during this extremely tense period. We have acted to restrict travel for Burundian individuals who reportedly have committed human rights abuses and will consider additional measures against anyone who plans, participates in, or orders widespread or systematic discriminatory violence against the civilian population. The United States supports no effort by the military to take over power by unlawful means. We continue to believe that adhering to the compromises contained in the Arusha Agreement, including its presidential term limits provision, is key to returning stability and unity to Burundi. Thus, we hope that President Nkurunziza will weigh the best interests of his country and his legacy as he considers whether to continue his controversial bid for a third term. His candidacy will undermine Burundi's economic and democratic progress. Some international donors have already cut or suspended financial aid. The United States welcomes the mediation efforts by the United Nations and African Union and urges all Burundian stakeholders to participate constructively to find a peaceful, democratic resolution to the current crisis. We particularly welcome the announcement by the International Conference on the Great Lakes Region of the visit of the presidents of South Africa, Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania to Bujumbura in the coming days to meet with all parties. Burundi has come far since the end of the last civil war that caused so many deaths and human suffering. The United States reiterates its strong support for the people of Burundi at this very difficult time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.